A very basic problem in theoretical physics is understanding how to describe quantum mechanically a relativistic particle moving in space-time. So typically, you might want to define just one particle, then perhaps start thinking about several particles and how these particles might interact. So the first obvious step is to ask, how could a theory of quantum mechanical particles, which propagate around space-time and occasionally interact with each other, look like? Then this leads to perturbative quantum field theory. And then to quantum field theory. So perturbative quantum field theory is the machinery that we use to describe a systematic approximation of a system like this, starting from a system of free particles, and then adding the possibility of occasional interactions between these particles, which happen at points in space-time. Then you're trying to make sense of this systematic approximation. You might try to look for a non-perturbative, a full definition of something which can describe a system like this. So in perturbative quantum field theory, you might have some machinery like Feynman diagrams or something else, which describes whatever quantities you're computing as a function of the interaction strength or how often interactions happen, which are the couplings, as a perturbative expansion. Where A0 will be the answer that you get sort of from the simplest possible processes, and then the corrections describe more and more complicated processes where more and more interactions happen. And then an actual quantum field theory, an perturbative definition of quantum field theory, would be some other recipe to produce the actual function, the actual answer as a function of the coupling, not just this perturbative expansion. And we know several different ways to give a non-perturbative definition of quantum field theories. We might use path integrals. We might use some lattice constructions. You might have encountered some of these in the previous lectures, the previous courses. And then once you start understanding quantum field theory, you also start understanding the limitations of the original picture. For example, in a typical situation, the quantum field theory will look very different depending on the scale at which you're probing it, depending on the questions you're asking to the quantum field theory. So typically you have some picture where you have some description that you've given at short distances of your theory in the UV. And then as you explore larger and larger scales, you might encounter plenty of situations when your theory is a theory of particles which are moving almost freely around and occasionally interacting, but not always. So it's perfectly possible at some scales you find particles, at some other scale you find something else pretty hard to compute, and then at some lower scale you find again particles, but perhaps some completely different set of particles than one you started with.
What do you mean by something else?
Well, for example, you might have a situation where typically when you have something else, it means that things are strongly coupled. Okay. So you have some excitations in your system, but they don't look like little blobs that move around and only affect each other when you're close to each other. But also what I mean is that this, with a question mark, I might also mean a situation where particles exist, but this picture is not valid, meaning that the interactions happen very frequently and really alter the behavior of the particles themselves. So here, perhaps I should have said weakly interacting particles. And weakly interacting particles. So an example would be QCD. In QCD, if you probe very high energies, you find quarks and gluons, weak, you know, happily streaming around. Their interactions become stronger and stronger at lower scale. There is some situation where we cannot do calculations except perhaps with the lattice. And then at some point, hadrons emerge, protons, neutrons, mesons, which are again at sufficiently low energy particles which are happily moving around with occasional interactions. Or nuclei, which go sufficiently low energy. Okay, so, but anyway, in quantum field theory, so that what I'm trying to say is that already in quantum field theory, when you study particles, you have this sort of picture, you try to give a meaning to it, first in perturbation theory and then non-perturbatively, and then you find the limitations of this picture. So saying that the quantum field theories are theories of weakly interacting particles would definitely be a misconception. Now you can try to do the same for a theory of strings. So the starting point would be to ask, okay, what is the theory of, how do I describe a single object which is a string in space and wraps a two-dimensional worksheet in space-time? And it's relativistic in quantum mechanics. The quantum mechanical. So you can look for a relativistic. This is a somewhat harder problem than studying a particle. There is much more information you need to provide to explain how a string moves in space-time. And the problem is much more constrained than the problem of a particle. It takes some work to figure out what, you know, a list of possible ways a string could move in a space-time. It's an interesting and rich problem. As you start collecting examples, you find some general common themes that are sort of intrinsic to the problem, and which are rather surprising and interesting. Now, the first observation is that a theory of strings at low energy typically looks like a quantum field theory, like a theory of particles. Simply because, at least if the string has a tension, this tension has a dimensionful thing. It sets a scale, it sets a typical dimension of your string. And so at scales much bigger than that, your string looks like a tiny little object, you know, with some internal structure, but still point-like. And so a theory of strings typically looks like a theory of particles at low energy. Many, many types of particles depending on the internal motion of the string. And the first surprising fact that among these particles, you typically find a graviton. So from the very beginning, a massless graviton. So from the very beginning, string theory gets tangled up with quantum field theory, with quantum theory and gravity, quantum gravity. So this is clearly one of the first reasons people are interested in quantum field theory. Quantum field theory includes a theory of gravity. Now, Another very nice fact is that string theory comes equipped with zone interaction. In quantum field theory, you decide what is your list of particles, and then perturbable quantum field theory, and then you add by end these interactions. And you say, okay, particle one can emit particle two with this strength. Or particle one and particle two can come together into particle three. But for a string, there is a much simpler way to add an interaction, which is to allow your worksheet to have non-trivial topology. See, once you understand how a string moves in time, it costs very little to allow the worksheet of the string to have a topology which is not a cylinder. So you can get to processes which start looking like several strings coming in, interacting, and going out. The string has strings have a very natural way to interact by reconnecting or breaking up. If you sort of take photograms of this movie, right, you see two strings which come together. And at some point, join into a single string, and then perhaps it again.
Mm-hmm. Then at the low energy limit, they will reduce.
Yes, that's correct. That's correct. So the stereo strings, once you give me a recipe for a string moving space-time, it will produce as an output a bunch of particles equipped with canonical interactions. And these interactions have a very special feature, which is that they are very smooth. What does it mean? In quantum field theory, the presence of these hard interaction points has a variety of consequences. One of the consequences is that when these points come together, you get divergences. Now, this is not by itself a problem. A lot of these divergences are actually crucial for quantum field theory to work, meaning that one of the ways the fact that... So a lot of these divergences are simply expressed in the fact that the perturbative description of quantum field theory is somewhat inadequate. There are phenomena in quantum field theory which could not happen in perturbative quantum field theory except through divergences, like such as renormalization of the couplings. But some other divergences are more severe. So, for example, if you try to set up a theory of gravitons, if you try to look at general relativity as a quantum field theory, you will find divergences which are more serious than they cannot be easily tamed by a process of renormalization, and which manifests sort of the fact that gravity as a quantum field theory has to be replaced by something else at higher energy. On the other hand, string theory is free of those divergences. You cannot really say the interaction is happening at some specific point. Things are smeared around, and because of that, there is sort of a natural cutoff to the divergences. The interaction points never get much closer than the length, the sort of typical length of the string. As a consequence, there are no UV divergences. So a way to express this fact is that if I take gravity, couple some quantum field theory, we always know that at some point something has to happen and something else has to replace it. On the other hand, if you take string theory, it's not obvious that it has to be replaced by something else at some higher energy scale. So string theories look like something which could be valid at all scales, up to the point where the notional scale breaks down. So string theories look like a potential sort of complete theory, which doesn't need a further completion, and which smoothly interpolate, smoothly transforms into theory of gravity and quantum field theory.
Mm-hmm. So could you repeat what you meant by when you take something out, something has to replace it?
So there are quantum field theories like QCD, which are perfectly self-consistent at any energy scale. In principle, you could have a universe which just contains QCD, no gravity, and would be perfectly self-consistent, perfectly self-consistent physical system. On the other hand, if you try to write down a quantum field theory including gravity, the strength of the interactions will blow up at some energy scale, something like a Planck scale, and then you'll need some other description. And there are some no-go theorems that tell you that this other description cannot be a quantum field theory. So you need something else. It's not quantum field theory. String theory produces one possible candidate for that something else. And it's kind of special in that it can potentially replace gravity in a smooth way, meaning that you can have a situation where a theory of gravity becomes a theory of strings while remaining weakly coupled. Indeed, perhaps you can turn this around and argue. There are ways to almost argue that if you were trying to replace gravity by something else without making it strongly coupled first, that something else would likely be a theory of strings. This doesn't mean that this has to be happening. It's perfectly possible that in our universe, you have gravity up to some point, things become strongly coupled, and something else emerges, which is not string theory. It's possible, maybe even likely, I don't know. But a way to think about string theory is that for various reasons, it's what more or less tends to emerge if you try to solve the problems, the short distance problems of quantum gravity while keeping things weakly coupled. You can think about as string theory sort of produces these big infinite towers of particles, which conjure in such a way as to remove the singularities of gravity. That would be sort of a way to get to it from below. But anyway, all that I'm saying here is completely perturbative, right? So I'm still at the first stage. And indeed, that's gonna be the main purpose of these 3 weeks, to get to a point where we can say, okay, there is some way to compute a perturbative expansion which gives a concrete meaning to these pictures. We essentially do not really know how to make the next step of giving a non-perturbative definition, a full non-perturbative definition of string theory. But before I can even say what that means, I need to say a few more things. So in particular, I need to talk about one more fact that will emerge from our analysis of this problem, which is that string theory have no continuous parameters. So when you define a quantum field theory, you get to pick the strength of these interactions. You get to pick these numbers. Now, they evolve in an interesting way as the scale, as you probe different scales, there is an RG flow, but these are still handles. You know, you can say, okay, I have a quantum field theory, I decide the strength of the interactions here, and then if I'm very powerful at computations, I can figure out everything else. And also, quantum field theories are sort of modular. You can always take two quantum field theories and put them together and make them talk by some interaction. these two properties are not valid for string theory. So string theory, in particular, string theory has no continuous parameters. Meaning every time you put a parameter in your construction, the parameter becomes dynamical. So the appearance of gravity, indeed, is an example of that. When you define a theory of strings, you can of a single string, you can say, okay, I'll make my string move in this spacetime or this other spacetime. Spacetime appears as a parameter at the beginning of your calculations. And then you find that there is a dynamical graviton which interacts with the other strings in just such a way that allows you to change spacetime and make it dynamical. And this ends up happening for every coupling. Now, even this coupling that I've wrote here schematically to indicate the strength of the interactions, how often strings interact with each other, it's actually a dynamical field. There's some scalar field, typically in string theory, called the dilaton, which tell you how strong are the interactions between the strings. Now, this is a rather dramatic fact because it means that you cannot even tune your parameters in order to make sure that this picture is actually sensible. Right? You could try to say, okay, I define my string theory as the first approximation is the theory of weakly coupled strings, and then I try to figure out what's actually going on. Well, the string theory might say, wait, the coupling is dynamical and actually wants to grow. So your initial description is completely useless. So this is like a bit similar to this sort of situation, except that this is not just the scale at which you're probing, it could be time. Or maybe more generally, you could say, okay, you define your theory as weak coupled strings, and you discover that this theory with weak coupled strings is not a good description of the system in any situation. Now, this is clearly bad because it prevents you from actually saying something sensible. Now, there are ways around this. So something called supersymmetry can be used to balance the quantum corrections of various fields in such a way that the coupling does not...
Can you maybe explain some more on why you don't have continuous parameters anymore?
Sure. So the full statement is perhaps that whenever you have a parameter, you can find an associated particle in such a way that the field you would associate to those particles is the parameter. It describes fluctuations in the parameter. So every continuous parameter is associated to a scalar field, which dynamically can evolve and change your parameter. And this includes the strength of interactions. So, right, so you can sort of make sure that, you can try to make sure that this field does not try to roll away from the place where you can control things. It's tricky. You can do it with the typical way we can do it in a controlled manner is using supersymmetry. It's probably not the only way it can be done, but it's the only way we know how to do it. So this leads to the definition of a bunch of perturbative supersymmetric string theories.
This supersymmetry allow us to like tell these interactions first so they can match. And
that's right. Supersymmetry in space-time can be used to make sure that the corrections to the potential to scalar fields that come from fermions and one can come from boson can be cancelled out against each other.
Okay, so I can have parameter. Like,
that's, well, yeah, there's going to be still dynamical, but at least the dynamic is under control. So they don't try to run away on you as soon as you start your calculations. There is something called tuples that you encounter in quantum field theory. When you say quantize a scalar field with interactions. Right? A tuple means that the equations of motion of the scalar field are not satisfied by the vacuum you're sitting, the vacuum you choose to start making your calculations. When you find a tadpole, you need to shift the place you're doing your calculations until you are in the correct vacuum. If you find tadpoles in string theory for the dilaton, then you are in trouble. Because if the moment you give a finite expectation value to the dilaton, you're not in perturbation theory anymore. Because the coupling is finite. It's not infinitesimal. So supersymmetry is a way to make sure that there are no tadpoles. Now, there could be plenty of other perturbative string theories which can be defined consistently without the help of supersymmetry. We just don't know them. Another problem with this situation is that it prevents us from doing truly dynamical things in the sense that supersymmetry is typically incompatible with things like cosmology. The moment you try to have an evolving universe, you break supersymmetry enough that you cannot trust your destabilization of the dilaton. So,
but does that mean that we cannot have supersymmetry, or?
No, it means we cannot do calculations. So these are not limitations of string theory, these are limitations of our computational abilities.
Okay, So professor, the limitation here is the Susie-Birkin scale, like 1 TeV? The Susie-Birkin scale is the limit.
Oh, this supersymmetry does not need to be just behind the corner. When I say supersymmetric, it means that there is a reasonable amount of supersymmetry which might get broken at sufficiently low energy so that you end up with a universe which is not evidently supersymmetric. Now, once you end up with something that looks like gravity plus quantum field theory, then the quantum field theory is going to undergo all the nice things that quantum field theory does. But all I'm trying to get is to a place where I can trust the statement that I have a perturbative theory which reduces to perturbative gravity and quantum field theory. And then stuff happens. Supersymmetry might go away at some point. Of course, people love to think about situations where string theory or supersymmetry were just behind the corner to be found in the next accelerator. But that's just a bias, not a necessity. So another problem with this picture is that we cannot do cosmology while remaining in this perturbative setup. So if you want to do cosmology, if you want to understand an actual reasonable universe, you have to somehow make sense of the big question mark, which is non-perturbative dynamics of string theory, which at the moment we don't know very much about. Now, of course, you could even doubt that there could be a non-perturbative definition of the theory at all. So now I would like to introduce another ingredient, which is what convinced people that string theory exists, rather than a bunch of perturbative string theories describing some universes which don't have much to do with ours. Still, before I get there, I want to say, in a sense, this picture is already enough to tell you something interesting, which is that you can find theories which have gravity at low energy and describe some kind of universes. And you can find actually a lot of them. And if you don't understand the dynamics, you might even worry that there will be a gazillion of them. And that it might be, there might be, see, there is a sort of particle physics bootstrap dream, which is that the dream that combining gravity and quantum field theory will be so hard and that it could only be done perhaps in one way. So that if you give me the standard model plus gravity and you're strong enough, you can reconstruct the theory of everything right away. Well, this is one of the reasons to doubt this is that even just staying within perturbative string theory, you can produce universes which kind of look like ours. It might not be exactly like ours. You might not be able to compute cosmology and dynamical processes in a reliable way. But still, as long as microscopic questions are concerned, they are kind of okay. You know, big global cosmology problems are very hard to deal with, but I think one lesson to get out of this is that perhaps just exploring the microscopic without thinking about the global structure of the universe is not enough to try to understand the theory of everything, whatever that means. Anyway, so after we get to define some perturbative string theories, we'll get to discuss the subject of deep brains. So, as I mentioned, you cannot easily combine different string theories. You cannot say, okay, I have one type of strings and I add another type of strings in some other color. Sorry. Use colors. You cannot say I have different type of strings and then maybe I make them interact. If nothing else, you know that each of these string theories contains a graviton and there is no sensible way to put more than one graviton in a theory. So that can happen. What you can do is to try to add lines to this picture. Now, if you just try to add particles and then again help them interact at points with a string, you would mess up everything. You would introduce interactions which have huge divergences. And again, I'm not saying it cannot be done, but has not been done in a successful way until now. What you can do instead is to add lines that on which strings end. So you can have pictures where some of your strings are closed and some of your strings are open. So that the closed string would evolve in time as a cylinder, an open string will evolve in time as a strip.
Then just the boundary.
Mm-hmm, that's right. So the boundary of your worksheet behaves like a line. The endpoint of the string behaves like a particle in some ways. And you can now have interactions, which again happen smoothly, but tend to go beyond my abilities of drawing. Where open strings connect and maybe interact with closed strings. And now here is where I get in trouble. But I hope you can sort of visualize a tube, that the tube can be connected smoothly to a strip. So you can study theories of closed strings coexist with open strings. What you need to define these theories is instructions of what to do with these endpoints. So a D-brain is a prescription on how to make endpoints work. For example, you could say, okay, I allow my strings to, my closed strings to move around everywhere they want, but my open strings have to have ends on specific places in space-time. So I could say the blue ends have to lie on a specific line in space-time. And maybe my orange ends have to lie on some plane in space-time. I can do something like that. So these prescriptions are what's called the D-brain. And now something fun happens, which is the fact that string theory has no continuous parameters. So in the same way as the space-time where these things move acquire dynamics in terms of gravitons, the locations where I tell my endpoints to be acquire dynamics in terms of shape. So these D-brains become dynamical objects. In addition, which are there in addition to your strings. When the coupling of the strings is weak, these objects are very heavy. They move very slowly and ponderously, while the strings quickly move around. But as you increase the coupling, they can start being as light and important at low energy as the strings themselves. So, and furthermore, you even realize that there must be processes which create or destroy these D-brains. So at some point you can argue that the original closed string theory would only make sense if you allow situations where these D-brains can be created and the corresponding open strings. So, which means each of these blobs of perturbative string theory sort of can be extended as theories of strings and brains. And these brains sort of provide you bridges which strongly suggest that all of these pictures can come together. So it's perfectly possible to start from the perturbative string theory, start moving in a space of couplings, and by the time the strings become strongly interacting and heavier, some D-brains might become lighter than the strings and might become new strings for some other theory. So this, so thinking about D-brains allows to smoothly connect these different perturbative pictures and also connect them with other things which we understand much less, such as M theory.
Mm-hmm. Is it possible for open strings to become closed or vice versa?
Yes, yes. So there are all sorts of interactions that can happen. Everything that you can draw smoothly can happen.
Mm-hmm. So first, do you start by one spatial extension, which is the string? And after that, you go to B extension, P the extension, which is the membrane.
Well, that's right. So here, you could have membranes which are also two dimension. You could have a membrane, a D-brain. You could have a D-brain which is a particle. So even if your theory was a theory of strings, you discover that it actually might include particles, which are these D-brains. They might be surfaces, they might be higher dimensional objects. The dynamics of brains and strings becomes very rich. And although we can only do calculations in perturbation theory, with some help from supersymmetry, we can sort of explore a bigger space. And in this bigger space, all these theories seem to be connected. So the reason we talk about string theory rather than string theories is that every string theory we have defined seems to be appearing somewhere in this gigantic blob. And presumably there is a lot of other stuff in this blob, which we cannot at the moment define or understand. So this does not solve the problem of giving a non-perturbative definition to the whole thing, but at least shows you that these perturbative patches can be connected. Do you have any questions? So so a way to say what string theory means, right? String theory is the name usually given to this, to whatever unknown non-perturbative object underlies all of these perturbative patches and connects them together. Now, right, so more or less the plan of the course is going to be the following. For the first week and a half, we'll try to define the simplest string theory called bosonic string theory. It's really not a self-consistent theory because it has a tachyon, but it's reasonable to a model to start understanding how string theory works. And in particular, one of the objectives is to get to compute the simplest possible scattering amplitude, where two strings come in and then go out. And it will take a surprising amount of work. Then, then after that, I will discuss dbrains, still in the context of perturbative string, of bosonic string. And then I will start, I will try to get into the definition of the supersymmetric string theories, sort of string theories which have no tachyons and can be reasonably believed to exist. Okay, and this will be more or less the last week of the lectures. There are, of course, plenty of topics which we will not touch at all. In particular, we will not be able to discuss anything about holography, although I believe there will be other classes which discuss holography. Will there? Actually, are there going to be any classes, any courses that cover holography this year?
Not this year.
Not this year? Okay. Well, that's unfortunate. So holography sort of provides one way to think about string theory in a non-perturbative fashion. More precise. I mean, in principle, through holography, you can define string theory in some configurations in a non-perturbative way. I'd say if your objective is to understand what string theory is a very confusing definition because it depends on the setup. Meaning, one of the things I find most confusing is that holography provides non-perturbative definitions, but provides different non-perturbative definitions depending what is the global structure of space-time. Which is really surprising, you know. Particularly if you come from particle physics, your idea is that you just go in the microscopics, you find your definition of your theory at short distances, and then you look at what happens at large distances. But in string theory, perhaps because it's a theory of quantum gravity, seem to resist that approach. So holography is sort of like string theory in a box, so quantum gravity in a box. You consider some space-time called anti-de Sitter, where there are some boundary conditions at infinity, which essentially make it into a box, the gravity equivalent of a box. And then the whole content of the box can be replaced by a quantum field theory that lives at the boundary of the box. So this gives you a non-perturbative definition of the string theory inside the box, because we know how to define non-perturbatively the quantum field theory on the boundary of the box. On the other hand, if you pick different boxes, you find different non-perturbative definition of what seems to be the same string theory. which is confusing. And we have no idea what sort of box would they need to even perturb the definition of something which has cosmology. What I find always tricky in this lecture is that there is so much we don't know that it's very hard to avoid making statements which are actually incorrect. So, especially if you try to give big picture and words. Now, in the rest of the course, will be very focused on mathematical details, which are correct almost by definition, but correct in a different way. So it can be frustrating, and it is a frustrating situation. The field. There are all sorts of interesting ways people are trying to overcome these difficulties, trying to get to quantum gravity in a variety of ways, to holography or not holography, to information theory. Some of these efforts pass to string theory, some don't. It's very surprising to me that essentially all places where we have found some non-perturbative thing which has gravity end up somewhere in this big blob. I don't know why is that. Perhaps it's because we always do things using supersymmetry, and this blob includes all interesting things you can do with supersymmetry. That's possible. Of course, I think one of the most amazing things would be if somebody was to find something which does not sit on this blob, some other blob. So when you study string theory, it's easy to get lost in studying some little corner of beautiful complexity. There is actually surprisingly few people at the moment working on big pictures, big questions, and perhaps that's not good. So I invite you in the course to try to understand. At the same, it's very hard, but try to understand. It's not just get lost in what string theory is, but sort of try to get a bigger. Try to ask yourself, okay, how things could. Which other way could things have gone? You know, hopefully at some point some of you will ask the questions which might bring us beyond this picture.
Mm-hmm. So earlier, what you were saying about maybe a CFT and how the non-perturbed description will depend on the choice of bots.
Mm-hmm.
But presumably that there should the non-perturbative description should vary nicely with the choice of box, right?
Point is that there are discrete box. There are discrete sources of box.
I see.
So it's true there are continuous choices of boxes, and in these continuous choices you can move smoothly and everything is fine. And there are very disconnected choices of box, which cannot be connected by simple physical processes. Unless they affect, actually, to which degree can they be connected is a very interesting question. Because somebody ever found a box which does not have string theory inside, it would have to be a box that cannot be connected in any way to the other boxes, because otherwise what you find inside would have to be connected with string theory. It's incidentally right. Another, you might also use holography to convince yourself that everything you'll find will always be connected in some way to this big blob. So very concretely, I can give you a list of quantum field theories, which don't look like each other at all. They're no obvious relation. They might even live in different dimensions, which are holographic dual to the same string theory in different boxes. And a priori, there is no obvious reason for which they should have the same string theory in the box. Because the theories are not connected in obvious way. It's confusing, you know. That, see, when I prepared the lecture, and I tried to say, statements like that non-perturbative completion of string theory. Right? Then you realize that even this statement that is sort of given as an assumption is very confusing. Is it really true that there is a unique non-perturbative completion, you know, a unique formulation which describes all possible manifestations of string theory in all possible universes that you can build out of it? Or is it possible that you have many different non-perturbative definitions that depend on somehow the global structure of the universe you're trying to describe? I don't know. And if you have many different non-perturbative definitions, how do you know which ones are connected? How do you know that they're describing the same thing? Anyway, sorry for asking.
The problem, so it's the connection between all this non-perturbative description, or why it's the reason?
Well, first of all those non-perturbative definitions only apply to very specific boxes in which there is no cosmology. So they're useless to try to describe our universe. So you need other non-perturbative things to describe a universe that resembles ours. And then you might still wonder, are there going to be several different ones or only one? On one hand, it's almost absurd to think that there could be multiple string theories that still have the same, they manage to cover all of these and still be different. But at the same time, it's not clear that giving a non-perturbative definition completely defines what string theory is. So we were in a place where I can mostly ask questions rather than give you answers. So, and any more questions?
Can you sort of big picture terms, what exactly is M theory? Because you mentioned it a lot.
Oh, right, M theory. Okay, I can tell you what are some properties of M theory. Okay, M theory is something that you can reach whose existence can be predicted by looking at some string theories. More specifically, you take something called Tuck-Chuey string theory. It has some particle-like D-brains, which, as the string coupling becomes strong, behave a lot like Kaluza-Klein modes of a graviton. So that if you look at all the fields and all the objects that exist in this string theory, as you make the coupling large, they organize themselves into fields of in one dimension higher. So they convince us that there is something called M theory, which sits on top of 11-dimensional supergravity. And it's quite different from string theory in the sense that string theory replaces gravity, adds new things on top of gravity when things are weakly coupled. Instead, M theory is an example of something which is gravity all the way to the Planck scale, and then something happens, which we have no control on. If you want, M theory is an example, is an example of the fact that quantum gravity can be computed in UV in various ways, some of which happen at the Planck scale, some of which can happen earlier on. There are quantum field theories which give an holographic definition of M theory in some boxes. There are all sort of M theories often gives you an organizing principle to think about a lot of things in string theory. Sometimes people say that M theory is a theory of membranes. It's a bit of a deceptive statement. The statement is true is that if you look at M-theory, at low energy, you'll find the international supergravity together with some object with very strong tension, three-dimensional or six-dimensional objects moving around, with very high tension, so tension of the order of the Planck scale. So these objects will become, the dynamics of these objects will become interesting at the Planck scale, but we don't know if these objects are elementary objects at the Planck scale or if they're just something that emerges from some Planck scale dynamics. That is like saying, if you give me a proton, it has a mass of the order of the QCD scale, but it doesn't. But it doesn't mean that the proton would be an elementary particle at the scale. Okay, so M-theory is a relative of string theory which has no strings.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so those dimensions like 11 or in boson 26, they are fixed because when you build up your Hilbert space, so you need to be ghost free, like there is no negative norm. So,
I mean, saying that the string theory has 26 dimensions is, or 10 dimensions or whatever, is any sort of imprecise statement. The correct statement is that what the thing that lives on the worksheet has to have a certain number of degrees of freedom. The simplest way to realize these degrees of freedom is to say, okay, these degrees of freedom are ten directions in which you can move. You could replace some of these degrees of freedom with something else. Okay. Now, when you are in a supersymmetric situation, the something else can often be interpreted as some other direction, so space-time may be curved into the compact manifold. But again, this is more of a lamppost statement than the statement about string theory. In the lamp, if you look at a place where you can shine light, that's what you find. So typically, all these perturbative supersymmetric situations can be continuously deformed to a situation where you have a 10-dimensional space-time. But you can also go to, you can go to places where the size of the space-time is comparable to the size of the strings. So you can go to places where you actually effectively only see quantum field theory in, say, four dimensions. And then you get to the string scale where quantum field theory and space-time are anyway getting fluffy. So saying that you have 10 dimensions is a... So, right, so... It's an imprecise but useful statement that string theory moves naturally in 10 dimensions.
And also, Professor, you said when upload energy, we can derive the quantum field theory or standard model. So for Einstein equation, if you go, to the classic limit, you can at some point or at some calculation derive Einstein equation from string theory.
Yes, but that's not a big surprise in the sense that once you know that said something reduces to quantum field theory, no matter what that something is, and you know that something gives you a massless graviton, then you get Einstein equations. I mean, that's, Einstein equations are the only self-consistent way to have a massless graviton in quantum field theory.
But Professor, first when they start the bosonic, for the closed string, and they compute the spectrum, they found that the first excitation of the second, it's associated to a tensor massless particle, which they said maybe it's the graviton, but we don't know.
There's no maybe. In quantum field theory, a massless spin two particle is a graviton. There are no alternatives. There are very simple calculations one can do to show that a massless Pinchu particle will couple to other particles, can only couple to other particles in a very specific way. Can only couple to the stress tensor, and it can only have self-interactions, which are the ones of Einstein gravity. So it's not a magical property of string theory. It's just anything that produces a massless graviton can only give you Einstein gravity plus non-renormalizable interactions. On the other hand, it's hard to produce massless gravitons, meaning if you start from a quantum field theory which has no massless gravitons to start with, there is a theorem by Weinberg and Witten that you cannot produce a massless graviton at lower energy. Which is an important and often neglected challenge to making microscopic models of quantum gravity. Meaning if you try to just discretize space-time and hope for gravity to emerge at low energy, you need to be very careful to avoid passing through a quantum field theory in the process. Because if you pass through a quantum field theory before getting to gravity, there is no chance to get a graviton. So it's a very interesting challenge. So somehow your discrete model will have to have a continuum limit which has the graviton emerge right away together with the quantum field theory. Because if it's not there, it's not going to appear later. Any more questions? Well, I guess it's a bit late, so